Hey there, cycling fans. Thanks again for joining us. As always, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podbeam, Overcast.fm, and give us a like, give us some comments, and send your feedback to cycletyler@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter at TYonky, and look for us on our own Facebook page as well, Between Two Wheels Podcast. All right, before we get on into the show here, let me just give you an idea of what we're going to be doing. We're going to start off with cogent commentary by Coach Nate Dunn of Data Driven Athlete, and then my own take on the world of cycling and some news and views of the day. All right, hope you enjoy.
Hi, this is Nate Dunn from Data Driven Athlete with a quick coaching tip. So most riders are familiar now with the term FTP or functional threshold power, but I want to talk briefly about where that term actually comes from. So it starts with the concept of the lactate threshold, and the lactate threshold is a maximal sustainable intensity that generally elicits a blood lactate concentration of about 4 millimoles per liter of blood. Now, when it comes to training with a power meter, we're not that interested in actual blood lactate concentration. What we're more interested in is watts. So what we've done is we've taken that blood lactate concentration of 4 millimoles per liter of blood and seen that that generally translates to somewhere around 60 minutes of maximal sustainable intensity. So this is the origin of the term functional threshold power. If you have any questions about the FTP or the lactate threshold, you can follow up with me at nate@datadrivenathlete.com, or you can check out our website at datadrivenathlete.com. Thanks.
Welcome to the Between Two Wheels podcast. This is episode 19. Your host, Tyler Yonke. I do not have Chris Flower and or Kurt Mills with me, but we're going to forge ahead, do a few little news recaps. You know, I went, we did a big ride this weekend with Kurt and Chris, and then Andrew Shimizu, who I believe was on our episode 4. You can check back on that, a really good interview. And then another friend of ours, Andrew Heineman. And we did a big bike ride on Saturday, starting out from Nevada City, the famed Nevada City crit up there, where one of our friends lives. And basically did a 70-some mile ride with about 7,500 feet of climbing. It was a really good time, and we had a chance to do a podcast afterwards, but instead we decided to just, we were thrashed. We decided to just kind of hang out, talk politics instead for some reason, and actually it was a really good time. So we did miss out on being able to kind of collaborate with a big group and have some conversation. But you know what? These things happen, and it's kind of just the way it is. All right, let's jump into kind of some news items that I've enjoyed over the last few weeks and some notes of interest. You know, the racing season is winding down, so we're going to kind of do less on that and try to see if there's some other aspects we can go and avenues and venues of conversation. And some things that just kind of hit my fancy. We've talked earlier about the Icarus and the Russian athletes that the Icarus documentary and then the Russian athletes that were subsequently not allowed to participate in the last Olympics in Rio. And there was a news story that came out recently where three of those athletes are suing for being excluded for the Rio Olympics. I think they're suing WADA. And I found a story on the BBC about that. It's pretty interesting how they don't necessarily say that, because what happened, and if you watch the actual documentary, what's interesting about it is the whole elaborate plan there with the doping in Russia for the Olympics, where they had a plan where they take an A sample and a B sample, and then the B sample was carried away and stored in a different spot. And then the A samples, the Russians were able to, they had a little secret hole in the wall, and they would take the sample, they would stick it out through there. A KGB officer or the GRU, I'm not sure what they're called now, but they would take that, and they were able to actually take these bottles where the specimen was in and have them opened up and resubmitted, and they put a clean sample in there and then, you know, put it back in through this hole in the wall and then put it in with all the A samples. So when the A samples were tested, they were going to be clean. The problem is those B samples were not. And the Icarus documentary went through all this. And one of the things he brought out at the time when they were reporting this to WADA and all the doping society was, hey, if you were to retest those B samples, they would show conclusively that all these people that passed in the Olympics were actually positive. And what they did is they actually went back and then they were positive. So, but now a lot of the people were ended up able to to participate in the Olympics as well. I don't know what the overreach on there, what the Venn diagram is of those that had that. But these three people that are suing WADA for not allowing them to participate in the Olympics, their B samples were actually positive. So the gall of these people to actually come out now and to say, hey, you did not allow me to participate when you were, your B sample was found to be positive. You know, the interesting part is, I don't know how that all works with the WADA code and the UCI or whatever their own governing body is, as far as, I guess it'd be a non-analytical positive, similar to Lance Armstrong, where he never tested positive, but then he was, basically he's a cheat, and he's been found to be a cheat. And like some of these other people, I think that, but they didn't actually ever have a test that they, you know, were found guilty of or positive on. So it'll be interesting to see that coming out. And it's also just interesting to see the elaborate avenues that some of these people will go to try to clear their name on an instance like that, where their name just can't be cleared in my defense. Okay, so now speaking of some other things about some names that need to be cleared, we had an issue earlier this year with Gianni Moscon of Team Sky, where he had racially insensitive comments to Reza, an African-American. Well, I guess he wouldn't be American. He's a Frenchman. He's a black Frenchman, rides for FDJ. And he, I guess there's some back and forth there, and Moscon, and we've talked about this previously, and then Moscon basically had some racial epithets at him. The teammate, Reichenbach, had sent out a tweet about it at the time about how, I think the quote here is, "Shocked to hear idiots still use racist slurs in the pro peloton. You're a shame on our sport." That's what he had. Now, he never mentioned who it was about, but it was obviously towards Moscon because it's his teammate of Reza. And, you know, that was the incident and it was publicly known. Now, Sky had suspended him for a few months. I don't think the UCI ever took any action towards that. And I'm not sure if what the UCI, I don't know what their role in this actually is. I guess you can do anything towards, you know, degrading the sport. And that's kind of what they've, you know, people were punching or doing other things. They can suspend you for that. So they probably should have taken some action and they didn't. I think they felt that Sky took it upon themselves enough to do that. So why did they need to weigh in? However, what has happened just this last week was Reichenbach now has said that Moscon deliberately pushed him off his bike to settle the score because of this tweet back in April, I believe it was. So the first thing is, did Moscon even push Reichenbach down? Now, Moscon says that he was near him on the time of the race, and Reichenbach's hand slipped off the handlebars and he went down. Reichenbach, however, has reported this to the UCI, and he's also reported it to the police, and he said that he has some people that will testify that that was actually what happened was, you know, I guess Moscon put his hands on him and Reichenbach went down. So it's a little, first of all, the tweet itself, the tweet from way back in April was somewhat naive, I think, in a sense. I mean, you get a lot of these, you know, these are many multiple countries and someone's using a racial slur. I get it. But I don't know instances offhand, but you definitely have countries going at each other and, you know, you hear this throughout tweets all the time in the news. You know, someone just doesn't like the Italians. They have an example of a reputation, you know, holding onto cars. That's kind of their big deal right now. And so some people maybe will say some derogatory things about them. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of things that are just culturally taken. So the racial thing, I think it's maybe a little naive for Reichenbach to say that he's shocked, because I imagine that stuff still happens. And, you know, you don't necessarily see very many people of color in the pro peloton, you know, no matter what race they are. So, you know, but then you have all these guys that are coming up from Eritrea and some of the other countries in Africa. And, you know, I would hope that those comments aren't being thrown around too much of a degree, but I'm sure it shouldn't be necessarily a shock. You'd still hear those things. Maybe it is. Maybe I think Reichenbach's from Austria, somewhere around there. Maybe it is a complete shock to him. However, I think the shock that the comment was made to a black person, because I can assure you there are, like I said, there's plenty of other races around and other ethnic groups. No one is speaking the correct language either. So I don't know what the full details of that thing are. Regardless, I think Moscon appears to be kind of a real wanker. and he's kind of solidified in himself in a place of cycling lore as like one of these true Italian jackasses. Okay, see what I did there? I said it. But he's becoming the Italian version of the French rider Buhani. Buhani's known as this guy that's rough and tumble, throwing elbows. And it's one thing, you know, I do crits. I've been in the sprinting aspect of that for a long time. And there are some guys that are really they're throwing their elbows, or they really, you know, they want to wheel and they're really aggressive, but they're not jerks and off the bike. Some people are. And that's just their overall mentality. But there's some people that are just really strong and, you know, they want to wheel and that's kind of the way they are. But they're not going to be throwing bottles at you. They're not going to, you know, you can have a conversation with them afterwards and you kind of respect them because they're in that position. And, you know, there's few and far between. So Buhani is definitely not one of those people. He seems to be an a-hole on and off the bike. He's had some punching incidences. He missed out, was it last year, a few years ago? Maybe it was a tour. He busted his hand, I think, because he'd been either hitting someone or hitting a wall. It was just some weird shit going on there. Anyway, so like I said, Reichenbach did make a complaint to the UCI and the police, and it'll be interesting to see what happens about that. All right, so earlier, I think it was right before the Vuelta, we had Sammy Sanchez of the BMC team get found positive. I think it was GHRP-2. I'm not sure exactly what that drug is, but come out that the counter analysis of the B sample confirmed the presence of the GHRP-2. Kind of the conclusion there is if you're going to be caught doping, do it while you're young so that you still have time to make a comeback. I mean, he's old. He's got no chance now. If he gets a 2-year ban, he's done unless, you know, he decides to make a comeback in mid-40s. So good riddance to Sammy Sanchez, and that's going to be the defining aspect of your career. Speaking of defining aspects of your career, and this is the example that I gave here of, you know, do it while you're younger, is Alberto Contador. Alberto Contador had the doping issue that he had, in the 2010, 2011, and, you know, he made his comeback. He still won some tours, and he still was able to, you know, he went out in a blaze of glory, as we know, and we talked about in the Vuelta. He's now come out, and he's basically saying, you know, that if it wasn't, you know, how did he say this? That he should have been, that this was should not be the defining factor of his career. And he feels basically that he said it's a tremendous injustice, he reported in some report. What stays with me most are the feelings of the people who saw those races, the 2010 and 2011 Giro tour in 2010, the Giro in 2011, and what they enjoyed of them, the way I worked to achieve them, and the way I achieved them. I don't give importance to what might appear on paper. It is about my own feeling. It's something I'm going to have with me my whole life. But it will not change anything. And the people that have shown interest know that is one of the biggest injustices that has happened in sport. All right, so he's basically saying that his positive test for clenbuterol was an injustice. Now, his revision of history is a little much, and people are going back, and the whole debate is kind of about, was this, you know, tainted meat as he said it was? And, you know, look, that can happen. There was Michael Rogers had an issue of tainted meat in China. That was a little bit different thing because that was clenbuterol in the meat was more of a problem. They had warned the riders of that when they went there, that could be a problem. And then they were able to trace that very specifically where that was never the case with Contador. Not only that, but you've got to remember if you look back at the actual suspension and what the findings were at the time, it was not just clenbuterol. It was DEHP as well. Now, this makes this positive a much bigger deal than just possibly unknowingly ingested tainted meat. The DEHP, it was a plasticizer. Okay. So now I went back and I found a whole article from the Scientific American about the plasticizers and their doping and what the whole issue was in that. So you've got Alberto Contador, and then they have this test where they can do to see what the plastic amount was in your system as well. So I'm going to just go right off here and kind of read some of the spots from the American Spectator. Let's see when this was done. This was February 9, 2012. And the thing is, widespread plasticizers cloud doping tests of cyclists. In a preliminary test in 2010, Contador's urine sample showed a spike in plasticizers that are found in IV bags used to store blood, according to the ruling by the International Sport Arbitration Panel. The theory is that a cyclist with plasticizers in his urine was using the IV bags for blood doping, illegally boosting one's red blood cell count to carry more oxygen to the lungs and muscles, as we know. But Contador's case has been controversial since the beginning, and he has vowed to appeal the ruling, saying that the widespread use of plasticizers in the environment has clouded the testing efforts of the sports doping police. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, funded research to develop a plasticizer test that would catch cheating cyclists. But so far, it's not the smoking gun that many have hoped for. Plasticizers, known as phthalates, are used in everyday products with possible toxic effects. The goal is to one day be able to prove that plasticizer spike in a cyclist's urine was due to blood doping paraphernalia and not, say, an accidental exposure from food. It continues on. The plasticizer in question is called DEHP, which is ubiquitous in the environment, says Shauna Swan, a reproductive entomologist at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, who has studied the effects of phthalates on infant boys. 98% of people in the USA have immeasurable levels. So now Contador's got two problems. Contador is basically saying, one, I've got tainted meat that got into my system that I didn't know how. And then two, there's this issue of the plasticizers. So let's go on with that. Contador's 2000 test showed a spike in the phthalates in his system near the end of that summer's Tour de France, the first time that the plasticizer test was used. His samples also tested positive at the time for clenbuterol, a performance-enhancing drug that riders have been known to illegally use in off-season workouts. Contador claims that the clenbuterol got into his system when he ate tainted steaks. The WADA and International Cycling Union said that the drug most likely came from an illegal blood transfusion because the plasticizer spike was detected the day before he tested positive for clenbuterol. Court of Arbitration for Sport in Lucerne, Switzerland agreed, overturning an earlier ruling by the Spanish Cycling Federation, which I'm sure had no bias in this situation. Contador, at the time of this writing, is now banned for racing for 2 years. And you could read the full PDF report that they have there. Like I said, he said he's going to go. And he did. He appealed the whole thing. His argument, as summarized in the ruling, is that the transfusion theory is scientifically impossible and that a spike of phthalates can be attributed to any number of legitimate reasons, yet research has linked the blood transfusion to the spike. So his problem there is manifold. And if you go on and read the story and you read the actual report, you'll notice that, it does. Look, drinking water bottles, water from a water bottle, you can sodas, all these things can lead to some DEHP in your system. However, he got a spike, and the spike was right at the time where he was also clenbuterol. So there was some issues there. I mean, it was too much. And if there had been a little bit less, the conclusions had not been so easily to draw that he might have been able to get off. So my point on that is he needs to, and it's easy for him because it's been a while, and all people remember from this is that he had clenbuterol in his system, which may have come from tainted meat. And they don't remember that the fact that he had high spikes of the DEHP as well. One more thing that he came back and said just this last week was he said he could have won all three Grand Tours in the same year. At this point, he's kind of becoming like these politicians that lose an election and just won't go away. I know some people want the ones that have won to go away, totally understand. But he's that one that you just want to just now leave and stop asking what happened. His quote actually was, "I've been able to win them, but in different seasons. If I had tried it and when I was younger and when I had a very powerful team around me, maybe I would have had more options." Okay, you mean you go back to the time when your entire team was riddled with EPO, blood bags, and whatever else you were pushing back then? I mean, you tried to win the Giro and the Tour in 1 year, which was, 2015, and that didn't work. Are you forgetting, Contador, that we all know you were caught in cheating and had your 2010 Tour title and your 2011 Giro title stripped from you? So now you want to go back and say, look, I had this amazing team, the team that we know what they were doing, and I could have won all three of these in the same year. Bloviate all you want, buddy. Clenbuterol, plasticizers in your system, and your team doped up to the gills, and that's what you want to substantiate your thing. But it was a true injustice, right? Okay, so we had some race results this last week, and two big races, Paris Tours and Il Lombardia. So we'll start with the Saturday Lombardia, which was actually pretty good. And it was won by Vincenzo Nibali. He won, I want to say, in a solo, which he did, but it was, let's just get the rundown. Nibali was first. Julian Alaphilippe was second. They were both separated from the, and then there was a small pack of Gianni Moscone, who we talked about previously, who came in third. Alexis Villermoz of AG2R, Thibaut Pinot of FDJ, Pozzovivo of AG2R, Fabio Aru of Astana, Nieve Quintana. And what's interesting, there's some pretty interesting things about that. One is about 16K out. This one, obviously, you can look at the makeup here. It's a very climby type of race, punchy stuff. And you get these GC type good climbers coming to the fore here. And obviously Nibali, who's won, what has he won, everything now? Giro, Tour, and Vuelta. And he obviously, you know, can climb. And he pulled this one out. Alaphilippe's no small feet as well. I mean, he can go uphill. Moscone showed that at the Vuelta. Interesting part about that, you look at the finish here, the finish sprint, and Moscone, Villermoz right behind him, was throwing his arms up like Moscone was doing something. You know, and that's just what I was talking about. He's starting to get a reputation. You look at it, the AG2R rider that was throwing his arms up looked like he was mad about Moscone kind of deviating from his line, and it was nothing. I mean, it was pretty really straight line, even as a sprinter would go. But you get these finishes where it's non-sprinters, and they're not really sure and used to how this goes. So some guy just kind of crosses the line again a little bit, pushes a climber into the barrier fraction, and they're going to freak out. Now, if this was a full-on sprint and you had your big guys, which you had in the Paris Tours type of thing, then you're going to, there's going to be no complaint because it wasn't much of a deviation at all. But let's just back up a little bit. And on the about last 16K, you had Nibali attacking, and who went with him was Thibaut Pinot. Pinot looked great. I mean, he was with him. He's able to hold the wheel. But then you started to have some really sketchy downhill. And these downhills were like wooded area on one side and kind of like wall on the other side, and they look like not even a full lane. Like, let's say you're going through a back alley of some little town, and they were a really fast descent in these back alleys, you know, hardly a one lane. Nibali, who's no joke at going downhill, was able to just get rid of Pinot. Now, if you think back a few years ago, Thibaut Pinot had some total mental issues with descending. I mean, he was one that came out where they thought he was going to be, you know, really threatening for the overall and maybe a new French hope for the tour. But he would get so frantic going downhill that it was just, he had some serious problems. And I think he had taken some, I mean, he took time in the off season and really worked on it, like with his mental stuff, going downhill, just a lot of practice with this. But I think he was getting like mental coach. I mean, it was something pretty severe. And so it was no, and Nibali knew about this. I mean, everyone knew about it. So you can see when he was descending, it looked like Nibali was almost playing some games with him where he was trying to do some mock braking for some corners. And then he would like sprint right before the corner. And you'd see Pinot kind of braking in anticipation of how Nibali was going through the corner, and then boom, there's a bigger gap. Nibali was pretty impressive doing some bike jumping over some barrier stuff, little things in the road to kind of avoid while he's descending at pretty breakneck speed. So he gets the win, impressive, and I'm sure this is probably the last race for him of the year. Then we had the Paris Tours race, which was won and by Matteo Trent and Quickstep Floors really came out there. They got third with Nicky Terpstra, and then they had Max Ariel Retkazy in fifth place for them as well. And then they also had Lampert in seventh. So they really posted in the top 10. But you had a little breakaway of Craig Anderson and Nicky Terpstra along with Matteo Trenton. And then Terpstra just lit the front on and basically let it out for Terpstra. Terpstra went, it looked like about 300, I'm sorry, Trenton went about from 300 out, and it looked like he might not be able to hold on. It was pretty, you know, lengthy sprint with Soren Anderson coming up, and it looks like, and then with about 50 meters to go, Anderson just sat up. So Matteo Trenton ended up with the win, which, you know, we highlighted him in the Vuelta, very impressive, and he was able to take the, what, three, four wins? And just missing out on the green jersey or the sprinter jersey, points jersey, as they call it, by Froome. All right. So enough about that. As I mentioned, this weekend we did a big ride, and like I said, somewhere just under 80 miles, a lot of climbing. And what was interesting, you know, you could probably go to your coach, but there's a thing called TSS, which is one way for you to quantify your workouts based kind of on your relative intensity, your duration, your frequency. As Training Peaks, who's kind of discovered this whole thing, they put out that it's one single value can now represent how hard and how long you worked out. 100 points earned by a pro is relatively the same as 100 points earned for a beginner, because TSS is relative to each person's individual threshold. So you'd have to know your functional training threshold first, and then you could get a TSS score. So what was interesting is we did this ride, and my TSS for the ride was like 230, and then my buddy and teammate Kurt and Chris, theirs was in the over the 300s, like 320 or so. And a lot of that has to do with it's not that, like, hey, they worked harder or that I didn't work. I mean, we were all just working hard and having a good ride. But it has to do with what your functional threshold is input at, or has been tested at, and what you're using that, and plus your weight and all these other factors. And it should kind of equal out for a ride like that. So it was interesting that it was such a vast discrepancy between it, which makes me think I need to maybe update my stats. And this is maybe something that you should be doing too as well if you're running through this. So I haven't done a FTP test in quite some time. So I just kind of run out and I'll do my intervals, and I'll say, oh, you know, I do a time up ridge or something, and I'm averaging, you know, 300 watts or something. And okay, so then maybe that's my FTP. And then, you know, I know my weight, and I could put that in and make sure then it should somewhat equate. And if you have a low functional threshold FTP in your system and you're putting out a lot more watts, then you're obviously, it's going to say, oh, wow, this person's really going above and beyond, and they're going to get a higher score. Maybe I need to look at that and make some adjustments and maybe go about doing an FTP test as well. Probably something not many of us do unless we have a coach. Probably need to get back on that as well. One other thing that just a question out there to you guys in general, which I was thinking about, was your helmet. When was the last time you washed the whole helmet liner of your helmet? You think about it. You know, we're riding out there and it got a little warm, and it's been a long day, and this, you know, sweat's coming off, and it's really rancid and nasty tasting because, hey, it goes in your mouth when you're riding up a climb. I'm like, when was the last time I washed this thing out? I actually had, you know, I've had multiple helmets of the same. I've broken a few. And so then you get an extra one or a new one, and they have extra liners in there. And I try to swap those out at different points of the year just to kind of give it a little bit of a reprieve. But I have not. And I actually am someone who tries to wash my helmet out quite often. But, you know, how you don't do it every time. And you think, if you think about it, you're like, I'm washing my chamois every time I'm going, my shorts. I'm not wearing dirty clothes. Well, there's that one team out there that may be wearing dirty clothes, and that could be part of that smell problem. But I don't have a smell problem, and at least no one's complained. Why? Because I wear clean clothes when I go out and ride, or I ride by myself. And so when was the last time you did that on your helmet? Maybe that's something to think about, or maybe there's some way you can maybe just wear it in the shower when you get done with a ride. I don't know. I haven't thought of that one as well. Okay, so what's coming up on the calendar? I know the Tour of Turkey is coming up, and that one's been interesting a few times. It lasts several years. It seems like there's been one or two guys, Turkey riders that have been nailed positive after they've won. And, you have a guy that doesn't do much, and then all of a sudden it's his home race, and he's just flying. I need to get back into that story. There is one. I'm trying to remember the guy's name, and he did a phenomenal ride. Up the fine, they have this a big climb that they've used there several times, and he just destroyed all these people. Now, some of it should, on its face, should be surprising, and yet it shouldn't be. Okay, you have a guy that's maybe been peaking for this race. He finally gets a chance to race in with some of the bigger riders, and it's, you know, we're in October. I mean, who's peaking for October? I mean, the worlds are done. These guys are kind of just waning. They're probably not really pushing for this, and so then now they're doing the Tour of Turkey, and you're like, I just get a trip and I just keep getting my paycheck. I don't really care. So winning a race where someone's peaked for it and really piped up to do well against guys that are just on the down low and not really interested, it doesn't seem too outrageous. But I'll have to look back into that story because it was pretty fascinating. Okay, so what we have now is We're going to start getting into what, you know, figuring out who's transferred to what team. Everyone's kind of dying down. Oh, one last bit of news that was interesting. It was Talansky. We know we had talked about him retiring, and now it looks like he's coming out to do triathlons. I guess he'd been a swimmer runner as a kid, at least he claimed to be. And so now he's, you know, posting stuff on Instagram where he's swimming. And, you know, I think he can do, you know, there's not many, if you're doing the full on Ironman stuff and you're really competitive, and look, he's going to be able to crush it on the bike. And if he can swim at all or run at all, he could probably be, do fairly well. And I think he'll be able to do also pretty good just financially, because I think it's somewhat similar to golf in a sense where you get your own personal sponsorship, and he's high enough up there with enough intrigue and still young enough where there's got to be some, you know, wetsuit company, runner shoes, maybe a bike company that's going to give him enough money, and he's going to bring some interest to that sport. Hey, you know, I don't really follow triathlons very much, or Ironman, but I will guarantee you I'll be interested to see what he does just from a pure interest perspective, and kind of, you know, I'll follow along and see what happens. And, you know, if it's either going to be some spectacular results or maybe a complete flop, who knows, but it will be interesting. I think he'll be able to do just fine. And like I said, with the less races throughout the year, he's probably going to be able to enjoy his family life a little bit more. Although, geez, you just went from bike training to now you've got to do bike, run, and swim training. So that's going to talk about, it just making me tired thinking about it. But good luck to him, and good luck to all those other ones out there that have retired and are moving on from cycling, except for Contador. I'm not a real big fan of his, as we discussed earlier. And all those that are still looking for jobs, and those ones that are coming up to the new World Tour level this year, it should be exciting for them. And I just, you know, good luck to everyone out there. So hope you enjoy your winter. We will be trying to still do these episodes once a week or so. So look for us. And once again, give us some comments, give us some feedback, and let us know what you think of any of the topics we talked about, or if you have just anything you want to join, you know, ask a question. Hey, if you think I have some sort of insight that you may be interested in, or you just want to embarrass me, feel free to do so. And take care, and we'll catch you on the next one.